Hello and welcome to the bonus edition of Soul Sisters this week with me, Claire Solon.
And me, Georgie Crawford.
This is the podcast that guarantees plenty of aha moments and healthy, nourished skin with thanks to Sanex. We've been loving the Sanex Skin Therapy Shower Gel lately. It comes in three different options depending on what your skin needs. We have anti-itchiness and anti-irritation. Designed for itchy skin, it contains omega-3 and reduces irritation in just 3 days.
We have anti-dryness, designed for dry skin and contains hyaluronic acid, known for its moisturizing power and smooth skin texture, suitable for combination to oily skin, and contains niacinamide, known to help reduce imperfections. So whichever skin therapy shower gel you choose this week, you're in great hands. Because why? It's developed with dermatologists. Its patented amino acid complex preserves your skin's barrier, helps support your skin's natural defense, and delivers a 24-hour hydration feel, because this year in 2026, we're all about protecting our skin health.
That we are. Hello and welcome to another episode of Soul Sisters, the bonus. And this week, we're going to the southern states of the United States of America. Now, first of all, before we start with before we head to Carolina, there is a police cordon outside my home.
What?
So it's interesting that we're talking about a crime, many crimes on the episode today, because there's been a crime committed not even 100 metres from me. So at 7 o'clock, I walked to the front of my home, looked out, and I could see loads of cars coming up my road, which is weird because it's a feeder road. It's not a main road. And then I looked down left, across Thrail Road, which is where the mayor of London City, Can, lives. And there's a police car parked right across the road, meaning that all of the traffic, which would usually travel down that road, can't. So, of course, I'm on the case. Sleuthy Max Sleutherson, out the door, put a pair of shades on, walk down to the corner of the street, look up. And sadly, I see two policemen, lots of cordoned, lots of tape, and a tent, which looks like a body tent.
Shocking.
I know. So that's a bit unsettling.
We're about to dive into the world of Alec Murdaugh.
Exactly. And the irony of the man's name being Murdaugh is not lost on me.
Okay, so I'm sure lots of Soul Sisters have watched the Netflix documentary like we did, all about Alex Murdaugh and his family. Now, I brought this up during the week with you, Claire, because I was like, I wonder, is it too niche to talk about this case? And you were straight back. You were like, I know this case inside out. So if the two of us know it inside out, it's likely that the Soul Sisters do too. But if you don't, worry not. We're going to fill you in.
She's got a timeline, everyone.
Yeah. So will we jump into it?
Yeah, let's.
So this is, there's been podcasts made out of it, Netflix shows. I'm pretty sure there's a series with actors at this point. But overall, it's a really, really sad story. And we've been following this for years and years. So it's about a man called Alec Murdaugh. Now, his name is spelled Alex, but, you know, in Southern Carolina, they pronounce it Alec. So in 1993, he met his wife, Maggie, and they married. And he was part of a really powerful family in Southern Carolina of lawyers. And there was a family law firm, and he was at the front and center of it. After they married, they had two sons, Buster and Paul, and the family became one of the most influential legal dynasties in the South. Like, they were well known. And I think we've seen the shows over the years of the power that attorneys have in states like that and in towns like that. So effectively, they ran that town, right, Claire?
Absolutely, 100%. You could see when you're watching the documentary on Netflix, the legacy and the generational control and wealth. For instance, in the court of law in this town, there is a picture of Alex Murdaugh's grandfather, which when he went on trial had to be taken off the wall. So that's how powerful they were.
Yeah, and I think we've seen it, you know, in various documentaries in the States, really, that you would think that police run towns like that, or the sheriff, but actually these guys had all the power. And I guess with that money and notoriety comes a lot of pressure, and this kind of keeping up with the appearances. And the pressure, I suppose, Alec felt that his kids, his two boys, would be just as successful as he was to pass down the family business. So things started going wrong around February 2018 when the family housekeeper, Gloria Sattersfield, dies after a mysterious fall at the home. And it later emerged that Alec had stolen millions from the insurance settlement that was meant for her sons. So apparently he approached the sons and said, "You should sue me because she died on my premises." And they followed his advice, and they did, but they never saw any of the money that was claimed from that insurance claim.
This Miss Gloria was not only a housekeeper, but she was very close to his youngest son, Paul. And again, I was watching the Netflix documentary. I hadn't picked this up the first time around. So Buster and Paul are the boys. Buster, a chip off the old block. Do you know what it reminded me of, actually? Harry and William. Buster is the William, and Paul is the Harry.
And the spare.
The spare, exactly. So by all accounts, Paul was a bit of a tearaway from very young, and actually was raised by Miss Gloria.
Yeah.
So because, you know, the mother just didn't connect to him in the same way that she did to the eldest son, because the eldest son went to university. He was in a fraternity. He became a lawyer, and that he was doing what he was supposed to do. Paul, on the other hand, wasn't. And he was very much left in the hands of Miss Gloria. So you can imagine when she died, how much of an emotional impact that would have had on Paul.
Yeah, it seemed like his world really fell apart when they lost Gloria. And I suppose it didn't really raise any red flags at the time. But just a year later, Paul seems to go off the rails. So in the documentary, you can see that he's drinking a lot. He's going out with his friends a lot, and he's really comes across as quite reckless. And he went out with his friends one night, and it seems like they were always the ones taking care of him. Like, he would get into a state of inebriation, and they'd kind of have to look after him. So they were out one night drinking, underage drinking, and he decided to drive the family boat. And there's still questions to this day as to whether Paul was driving the boat or not when it crashed and his 19-year-old friend Mallory Beach was killed in that accident.
When they went to an oyster roast, and they stopped the, watching it back, it's devastating, isn't it? When you see the kind of post-match analysis of a situation like this and all the decisions that were made that led to the accident. So they were driving back from the oyster roast. They'd been offered numerous lifts, but they said no. Paul didn't feel that he could leave the family boat somewhere, and so he insisted on driving. The problem was they stopped off at another bar on the way home, went in, had some more drinks, him and another guy called Connor. They came back to the boat. Paul was too drunk to drive it properly and kept stepping away from the wheel. Everybody was sort of panicking and trying to steady the boat. And then it crashed into a bridge.
It's so sad.
Shocking. It tossed out a guy called Anthony and Mallory, whose friends, Morgan, Miley and Mallory, they were three best friends that were going out with three Southern lads, one of them being Paul. They all get up onto the bank of the river and they look back in and they realise Mallory Beach is gone.
Oh, and it's just one of those things that, you know, when you watch a documentary like this as a 40-year-old or as an older person, you're just looking at all the decisions thinking like, this is so reckless. You know, this is so avoidable. And it's like when you're a young person and I suppose especially Paul, who probably never suffered any kind of consequences of his actions, the recklessness of the decisions. And that's, I suppose, what we all try to instill in our kids is, you know, to have sense, to make the correct decisions, to not get into a car or a boat, in this case, with a drunken driver.
It's heartbreaking to see them look back now, years later, and say, you know, none of them follow their instincts. And, you know, when you're in your teenage years, you just follow the herd. You don't follow your instincts. And what was quite scary, actually, was to see how quickly the Murdaughs got involved. So anytime Paul got in trouble, it wasn't the police he called. It was his grandfather, Mr. Yeah. Randolph. So Miley, his girlfriend, talked about a situation where he drove them off the road one night drunk. He called his grandfather. His mother, his father and his grandfather showed up, didn't even ask if everybody was okay, went straight to the van, took out the guns, all of his guns, which were in the back of his car, took out all of the beer cans that had been strewn around the place, and then came back to Miley and said, why did you call the police? For fear of their son's retribution. So it was the same situation after the boat, into the hospital, and all of the young people talk about Alex and his father showing up and intimidating witnesses, speaking in hushed tones to police officers, and then suddenly the crime scene starts to be tampered with. So the boat that they were travelling in mysteriously disappears. The family of Mallory come down to the banks of the river and they want to go down to where the accident happened. The police tell them, no, it's cordoned off. It's a crime scene. You can't. Suddenly they look to the left and they see the Murdaughs driving down to the banks of the river. So
the power that these guys had in that town. And it's almost like, you know, what you're saying there about the beer cans in the back of the car and, you know, being so front and center that night in the hospital. It seemed like they were very good at rewriting stories or rewriting facts.
And I guess as a family of lawyers, that's what they had been trained to do.
So at this point, it seems like the Murdaughs had lost a lot of support in the area and people were really disappointed in Paul. And he was kind of turned in to the black sheep then at this point. He was kind of rejected by the tribe. He was seen as very troublesome from that point onwards. And it was like they kind of couldn't hide all of his problems anymore. He was really exposed. And you have to also remember that he was still a kid, you know, he was still a teenager. And it seems the way the entire situation was handled was so detrimental to him and his mental health.
He was never convicted of any wrongdoing in that situation. And the Murdaughs had tried to frame his friend Connor.
Yeah, that's so bad.
Which, you know, they went as far as Alec, who was actually a friend of Connor's father, because again, these people all grew up with each other and have stayed in this particular town in South Carolina. Alex one night said to the Connor's father, Mr. Cook, come and let's have a conversation. And then he keeps, as he meets him at the law firm, he starts to feel like this is definitely a setup. And Alex Murdaugh is like, no, we're not, don't worry, we're not filming you. Don't worry, this is not a setup. And of course, Mr. Cook is thinking, well, if you would stop saying that, maybe I would believe it. But this is absolutely a setup. So again, what they were trying to do was rewrite history, whitewash this crime, and take Paul out of suspicion.
And I think behind the scenes, Alec was also dealing with a serious drug problem, which he had been hiding for about 20 years. So he was addicted to opioids, and apparently he was spending like 50 grand a week on pills, which is just, how can you even get your head around how many pills that must be and what it must be like to lead this double life? And that addiction, he says, made him paranoid, dishonest, and at the end of the day, financially desperate. And I think the more money you have, the more money you spend and the more money you need.
Exactly. And there was so much going, like you say, there was so much going on behind the scenes for Alex Murdaugh. He was at fraudulent activities. He was stealing from clients. He was buying drugs. And I thought it was really interesting to hear Miley, again, the girlfriend or the ex-girlfriend of Paul, say that she spent a lot of time with his wife, Maggie, Paul's mother. And at one stage, Maggie said to Miley, as if to kind of bring her in and allow her to see what was going on behind the scenes in the firm, Randolph Murdaugh, Paul's grandfather, was married to a woman called Miss Libby. Miss Libby at one point said, I want a divorce. What did Randolph Murdaugh do? He printed her obituary in the local paper that he had written himself.
What?
As a warning sign, you do not leave this family or get away from me unscathed.
Whoa. So it was around then a year after the boat crash, when everything began to crumble for Alec himself. So investigation started, you know, into his finances, and it was revealed that he'd been stealing client money and creating fake bank accounts and this whole different world that he was involved in. And it seems like at this point, he became absolutely desperate. Mm. And in 2021, just 2 years after the boat crash, Paul and Maggie were shot dead at the family home. And this was so shocking at the time. And when the police came and Alec was questioned, he said he wasn't at the family home at the time. He was visiting his sick mother.
I watched this episode back of the documentary, and it's fascinating. You know what's fascinating about the US justice system? Is how you can get access to all of the, I know it's now a kind of a global thing, but the body cam footage. Mm. And also you can hear phone calls that take place between prisoners and their families. It's just an amazing insight in for the public to have. So I watched this particular bit back where his 911 call from his land, and he was down by an area which was probably the hunting area. The dogs, there was loads and loads of dogs in cages, and there would have been rifles and guns down there too. So Paul and Maggie were down there for some reason. And then Alex makes the 911 call, and he's, of course, sobbing, distraught, you know, immediately, again, using really suspicious language around the situation. He immediately says to the police officers, my son was involved in a boating crash a couple of years ago. This is connected to it.
Yes.
Leading them directly to where he wants them to go. Also, there was footage found on Paul's phone, which proved that Alec was down in the hunting area with his family at the point where he said he wasn't.
Yeah, and this was like a huge, huge moment in the trial. So Alec had said, and actually I watched the footage from the police officers that night, and Alec is sitting in the car telling his side of the story of where he was. And I think a real sign that someone could be lying is when they go into like extreme detail.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you came back to your flat and there had been a murder and the police said, where were you? You would say, well, I was visiting my mum. You wouldn't go into detail about why you visited your mum and, you know, things like that. You would just be like, I was in my mum's, full stop. Like, there seemed to be this story being told. And what happened was he didn't realize that Paul had either, I think it was a Snapchat video, was it? He had sent a Snapchat video and his dad's voice can be heard in the background. So that was a real gotcha moment when the prosecutor said you're in your mum's house, but here's a video posted at 8:44 p.m. and we can hear your voice in the background. Now, you can watch his cross-examination on YouTube. It's absolutely fascinating. He seems to cover himself by 3 minutes before Maggie and Paul were shot dead. And in those 3 minutes, he said he went back to the house and was lying down. And that's when they were shot. And no surprises, he was found guilty of their murders and sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences. And afterwards, he was put into jail for something like 70 years for his financial crimes as well.
I watched, again, just to return to the footage, the body cam footage. At one point, there is a policeman talking to him and he's saying, are they dead? They're definitely dead. They're definitely dead. And the policeman says, yes. And he goes, And then another policeman approaches and he says, hey, how you doing? And the policeman who had been speaking to him looks and then looks back at Alex like, wait a second. Flicks. From, you know, devastated father and husband to, hey, how you going? To local law enforcement. So there was, as you said, there was like so much evidence to convict this guy. It was, there was, I don't think anybody had any doubt in their mind that he was responsible. However, we find out now, as of May 2026, that the conviction has been overturned. How?
Yeah, this is such a turn of events, and I suppose why we're digging back into this trial. So this month, the South Carolina Supreme Court overturned his 2023 murder convictions and have now ordered a brand new trial because the judges found that the court clerk, Becky Hill, was influencing the jurors. So apparently, Becky Hill, whose job is to look after the jurors and, you know, bring them in and out of the courtroom and things like that, allegedly told them not to be fooled by his testimony. She made comments attacking his credibility. She discussed his body language. And the court ruled that she basically inserted herself into the case, partly for publicity and book sales, because she had written a book about that trial. So the whole thing has been turned on its head. And now he will go to trial for the second time, accused of murdering his wife and his son.
What's very interesting to me is that Becky Hill, again, who I would have seen first in my first watch of the documentary, is all over the Netflix show.
And that's a really, like, that's a good reason to go back and watch it a second time through different eyes, right? Like, what did you make of her when you were watching it again this week?
Oh, like, you know, without being too disparaging to her character, local busybody.
Oh.
So one of the first things Becky Hill, which is so funny, not to be confused with the singer, says on this documentary is, my daughter was going to be called up to nearly got called to be in jury service. She was so excited. I'm like, you work for the court, Becky. Excited is probably not the language you should be using right now. She and then talks about Alec Murdoch coming. Oh, yeah, that's another thing. They call him Alec Murdoch.
Mm.
But you read Alex Murdaugh. But
yes,
in the southern states, they're absolutely doing their own thing. I suppose much like we would in Ireland with some of the language, too. So she talks about the moment that he walks into court. And see, this man was a master of disguise, absolute charisma, you know, personified. And he turns to her and he says, "Hello, Miss Becky, how are you?" On the day he was coming to court to face charges of murder against him for the death of his son and his wife. And so she's commenting on this and how relaxed he was and how confident he was of getting off. I mean, to be honest, it got my mind whirring in the sense that if you think these Murdaughs know all of these characters so well, all of the people that work in the court, they would have been making their way around to all of these people and the characters in this story to see if they could infiltrate them.
Mm.
So you wonder how vulnerable somebody like Becky Hill was to being infiltrated.
Yeah, and like I guess now it's kind of, where is Buster, the surviving son, and where does this whole thing leave him and his reputation? So Buster has stayed mainly out of the public eye, but he's always pushed back and said that he does not believe that his dad was capable of murdering his mum and his brother, which I guess you would have to believe, right, in a situation like that.
He's a very innocent looking guy, but there was also some controversy around him. Did you hear about Stephen Smith, or did you read about Stephen Smith, who was a young man who was killed in the local area, and his family believe he was killed because he was gay?
Mm.
And they thought, rumours were that Buster was involved.
Yeah, and he's always denied that. And they do touch on that. I mean, there is just an absolute web. If you had a wall and you had to put up the timeline and the murders, the money, the drugs. I mean, I'd say we only know the tip of the iceberg when it comes to this story.
Mm. Stephen Smith and Miss Gloria, both of those bodies were exhumed around the time that the trial was taking place, because law enforcement definitely felt that there was more, you know, had Alec killed Miss Gloria and had Buster been involved in the death of Stephen Smith. So yeah, as you say, it's in their DNA, you know, to literally change history. And you know, I always think, like, what kind of a brain imagines, okay, I've got an issue here in my life. I've got something that I need to solve. I'm going to kill. When does that ever work out for a person?
I know. And that's why, you know, Alec has, you know, always maintained that he adored his wife, Maggie. And he even calls Paul his nickname, which was Pawpaw, the whole way through the trial. And I've listened to a few podcasts this week on it, and it seems some of the experts in the US kind of think that it's going to be hard for them to get a conviction. Now, why would that be the case? So apparently, they would use all the same evidence. So the kennel video, which is devastating to Alec's story, the cell phone data, which puts him in the area at the time of the murder, the vehicle movement, his lies to the police, and then obviously the financial pressure and the motive there. The defense apparently would now focus heavily on reasonable doubt. and jury bias. So they will say the original investigation was sloppy. No murder weapons were ever recovered. There's no blood evidence directly tied to Alec. And that investigators became obsessed with Alec too early and didn't look at other possible motives in this case. So it's going to be apparently one of the biggest retrials in modern America. It's going to cost the state millions and millions, and it could be next year before they head back into the courtroom.
I suppose it's important to say as well, it really doesn't change the state of Alex Murdaugh's life. He will remain in prison for all of the financial and fraud that he committed, the financial crimes and the fraud that he committed. But I guess what's at play here is cleaning up the Murdaugh name and the legacy. I saw a line, you know, the story isn't about whether a man killed his wife and son. It's about what happens when a family that controlled justice for generations suddenly become the subject of it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with the obsession with true crime and, you know, in inverted commas, the internet doing its work, it's like families like that can't get away with what they once did. And, you know, everyone is obsessed with this. So they're going to have to make sure that the second trial is absolutely run to perfection, and there's no huge F-ups like there was in the first.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you watch the documentary, the talking heads are excellent. All of the young people who are now obviously in their 20s, all of those teenagers who were involved, all the parents of those teenagers, all, you know, they are able to comment about first-hand witness accounts. They're able to talk historically about their experiences with the Murdaughs. And by all accounts, the Murdaughs would take people to the Kentucky Derby. They would go to Guatemala fishing. They would have big barbecues and they would be drinking. You know, they would give the kids alcohol from age 13, 14, 15 upwards. It was just, everything was done to excess with this family. And I think certainly what the prosecution will have to do is dig deep into the fabric of this town and really bring out maybe previously unheard witness accounts around the lives and actions of the Murdaughs.
But sometimes, like, is a story just so complicated that they don't know where to begin? And it's been so many years since these murders. Like, how do they go back and prove it and make sense of it when the initial crime wasn't treated in the correct way?
Agree, totally. And the interesting thing is, again, the Murdaughs were known for helping evidence disappear, you know, to get them cleared. So now it'll be interesting to see whether they will be able to do the same thing in light of this second trial.
Yeah. So I suppose, like, I'd be wondering, like, what's he up to in jail? You know,
yes,
all day, every day. Like, what a completely different lifestyle he's leading now. You know, the drugs, the money, the fame, everything that he had. You know, a lovely lifestyle by all accounts. Even though when you look behind the curtains, it was probably hell. But he's always denied the killing of Maggie and Paul. But apparently, he's like a jailhouse celebrity. Because, you know, he was such a celebrity in his town. So apparently he receives loads of special attention from other inmates. He spends all day reading. He's constantly referring to the case and working on the case. And he's exercising and writing letters in there.
I suppose, like you say, what's happened now is he's been cleansed of all of his poison, his addiction. He's not on opiates anymore, and he's returning to what it is he does best, and that's law. You know, in terms of a fantasy, he can keep predicating this lie, and it's nearly like he's representing somebody else while kind of representing himself on this.
Yeah, that's such a good observation.
You know, and even by looking at the man, you can see you can see generationally, I definitely, by looking at Randolph, the grandfather, he was a, you know, oftentimes the patriarch is like the big guy with the brains, the one who started the legacy. And then as you see going down as each generation is born, you know, you often see in these very rich families how, I suppose, they've had everything they've ever wanted, but they never had the basics. So they never had love. You know, they never had the right kind of discipline.
It's a feeling of safety.
Yes, no guidance. But so the body cam footage again is interesting because you see once he's finished talking to the police, Alex turns on his heel and goes, "Randy, Randy, Maggie and Paul are dead." So again, ringing dad.
Wow.
I'm sure the father's thinking to himself, these good kids.
These idiots.
These unbelievable idiots.
And we've seen that time and time again, haven't we? Like, you pass the family business down and the next generation's just absolutely obliterated. So loads of people are saying, like, you know, what's going to happen now? What if he is acquitted in the second murder trial? Is he going to walk free? Is he going to get out of jail? So chances are no, because he was given 40 years in federal prison, a sentence of 40 years for that financial fraud. But I think a character like this, I mean, if he's able to get these murder convictions overturned, he's going to go for the financial ones next, right?
No doubt.
And interestingly, they were discussing this on a podcast in the States this week that, you know, is there a way that he can say he pleaded guilty to the financial stuff because he was already convicted of murder? And so is there a route for them to try and get that overturned or reduce sentence there? Who knows?
Definitely worth, if you're interested, and this has piqued your interest, going back and watching the documentary on Netflix. It's, I wouldn't say that I've been fully sucked into the wave of crime podcasts and crime documentaries. I don't watch them all. This is very well made. And it's just a really fascinating story.
What do you think? Like, what is it about it that connected with people so much, do you think?
I would say, first of all, the power of the downfall, you know? Yeah. We just are so, we can never get enough of a big dynasty having a downfall. And then also the humanity of the story, losing Mallory Beach, who by all accounts was an amazing young girl with a really bright future. So as I said, like the talking heads, the witnesses, the parents, everybody did such a good job of filling in the gaps in the story that it's massively compelling all the way through. I think there's about 6 episodes in total, but it's gripping.
Yeah, and it's a hard watch, you know, to see Mallory's family and her friends and, you know, the life that she could have had if it wasn't for the recklessness that night on that boat, you know, allegedly at the hands of Paul. So, yeah, a really, really sad story. And I guess, you know, I can't help but think of Maggie at the end of it all, you know, a woman who allegedly was about to leave Alec and had told her sister that she wanted out of this marriage. So do we believe Alex's side of the story that he was utterly obsessed with her and loved her so much?
I think, you know, Maggie was starting to look into the finances, lift the hood, you know, on what was going on, lift the lid on everything that was going on behind the scenes. And I think that would have driven Alex to do something really severe.
I think, you know, when you watch something like that, you kind of turn it off and, you know, you might put the cushions back on the couch in the way that they were and fold up a blanket, you know, you might have been sitting with, and just think to yourself, Jesus, thank God for my simple life.
Yes.
I mean, money, power, like, talk about being overrated. You know, all we need is a roof over our head and a feeling of safety and love at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah. And I suppose what's really stark is what the absence of that can do to a person.
Yes. What the absence of that can do for a person. Wow, Claire, that's so powerful.
You definitely see it in Alex, but you 100% see it in that Paul, little Paul Paul.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what happens next. We will be following it along with the rest of the world. And yeah, that show is on Netflix, 6-part documentary if you want to check it out.